These are the barren lands, the frozen wastes, the badlands of the far north. Canadian Shield is a vast plate of ancient rock. Huge glaciers have worn it down to the bone. Winter here lasts for 8 months. In February, the thermometer plunges to way below 30 degrees Celsius. In November and December, the sun rises at 10 in the morning, and by 3 in the afternoon, it's already the dead of night. The storms that roll down from the pole are relentless. To survive in this desert of ice is almost impossible. Nobody lives here in these barren lands. The entire Northwest Territories are almost a third of the size of the United States, yet have a population of no more than 43,000. It has long been known, though, that this desolate region is a gigantic and fabulous treasure chest. There's gold here, and silver, copper, zinc, platinum. But nobody ever dreamed there'd be diamonds. And then, in the summer of 91, the cry rang out through the far north.
Diamonds!
There were diamonds under the ice. Magnificent ones, so limpid and transparent, they could drive any jeweler in the world mad with envy. And there were lots of them. But they were a long way away, almost beyond reach. It'd be a gigantic struggle to mine them. There were two open pit mines at Diavik. It was time to go underground and continue to mine the diamonds. And there were diamonds there in the chimneys of the old volcanoes, down 600 meters below ground level. They started off with open pit mining. Only the top part of the kimberlite pipes can be mined this way. To get the rest, they had to go underground. They used traditional mining techniques, digging successive galleries until they reached the volcanic rock known as kimberlite.
We're 100 meters down in a 110-meter shaft in the drilling cabin. We're drilling holes in the kimberlite. For the dynamite, for the diamonds.
Kimberlite is a brittle volcanic rock. So for safety reasons, there's a metal grate in place to hold the roof up and prevent any rockfall. A series of holes are drilled in the gallery floor. Explosive charges are placed in each of them and set off. The explosions blow through the floor to the gallery below. The ore is gathered up by a loader and transferred into special trucks that haul it out of the mine. Thank you. Traffic underground is a difficult business. Each vehicle is in permanent communication by PC radio with a traffic control center. The galleries may be spacious, but there's no room for two trucks to pass each other. The loaded truck always has priority. The unloaded one has to pull over and give way in a lay-by dug into the rock wall. At the end of the summer, tunneling begins in the second Diavik mine kimberlite pipe, the A418.
Bottom of the A418 pit. It's over 200 meters below the ground surface, and above us is some of the strongest and oldest rock in all the world. And around us and on the ground is kimberlite. This is kimberlite, and it could contain diamonds.
By the end of June, the ice has all gone from the lakes, and the whole landscape looks different. 55 million years ago, there were huge trees growing here and giant ferns. But a series of immensely powerful volcanic eruptions turned it all into an inferno. When the eruptions ended, the lava all solidified, and within it, diamonds. Of the 5,000 kimberlite pipes discovered in the world, only 23 contain diamonds worth mining.
The diamond deposits here at Diavik were all initially underwater, so these dikes had to be built to pump out the water, provide access to the kimberlite deposits, and enable open-cast mining to get at the diamonds themselves. When the mining's all done, the clock will be turned back, the water will be let back in, the dikes all broken up, and it will all become a lake once again.
Leon Willier is 45 years old. He's been a driver at Diavik for more than 10 years. He drives one of the giant trucks that haul the kimberlite from the pits. Leon is from the indigenous Tlecho Nation, one of the first peoples to dwell between the Great Slave Lake to the south and the Great Bear Lake to the north.
You've got to be very careful going down the ramp. Don't lose control of the vehicle. It's a steep slope and it's long. A vehicle like this doesn't stop easily.
There are many indigenous people working the mines. There are almost 300 of them at Diavik, a quarter of the total manpower. Before development began, the mining companies signed agreements with the indigenous peoples who owned the hunting and fishing rights for the territories in question. You have to be a highly qualified driver to drive a 218-ton truck. The equipment's all supersized here. Training and jobs are part of Diavik's community commitments, as well as respect for the environment and the payment of royalties to the various communities.
The kimberlite is loaded down in the pits. You have to be careful bringing it up. You mustn't lose your load on the way. It has to get to where it's going. You can't just spread $1 million cargo all over the road. I don't know what would happen if you did.
The kimberlite is delivered to the hilltop treatment plant a few hundred meters from the mine shafts. It is tipped into a chute where a series of conveyor belts carry it through a whole chain of processes. Nobody ever touches the kimberlite. The whole procedure is entirely automated. The plant processes up to 2 million tons of ore every year. No chemicals are used to extract the diamonds from the kimberlite, simply the fact that they are denser than ordinary stones. The kimberlite is broken up, sieved, and washed. The diamonds are located by X-ray and extracted by an automatic compressed air system. They leave the mine untouched by human hand.
This is the last stage in the processing plant. From air, it goes to the Yellowknife facility to where it gets separated for market.
The quality of a diamond depends on its transparency, the absence of impurities, and its color. The batches of diamonds from Diavik are evaluated at Yellowknife, and this evaluation will determine the amount of royalties to be paid to the Canadian government. The diamonds are shared out between the mine's associates. 40% go to Harry Winston and 60% to Rio Tinto. Feasibility studies are underway for another open pit at Diavik.
Our challenge is to find diamonds. Diamonds in an area at least the size of Europe. It's very difficult because diamonds are only maybe 1 centimeter if it's a big one, or 2 centimeters if it's a huge one. My name is Lou Covello. I'm a prospector. I've been prospecting in the Canadian Shield for more than 40 years. I'm in this business is because I enjoy it so much. It is a terrific environment to work in. There's no better place that you could be to work. You get to work outside a lot. You get to physically challenge yourself, mentally challenge yourself. And you get to do it for a long time. It's like a detective job in that you're looking for something. You don't even know if it's there, but it might be there. And if it is there, does the approach you're using, is it a valid approach? Will it be successful? You never know until you actually find it. If you don't find it, it doesn't mean that it's not there.
To be a prospector, you have to buy a state permit. It's not very expensive. Then you need to buy a claim. In other words, the exclusive prospecting rights on a parcel of 1,000 hectares of land. That's not very expensive either. What is very costly indeed is getting both people and equipment out to such inaccessible spots. It takes time, a lot of effort, and a lot of disappointments. In the old days, prospectors used to disappear into the bush for months on end with nothing but a radio to keep in touch with the world. A bad fall, an accidental wound, or a run-in with a grumpy bear could all spell real trouble.
To my mind, the key to prospecting is the input of human intellectual capital. All of the commodities that we consume now in the world are, for practical purposes, inexhaustible. The Earth's crust is essentially inexhaustible. And the only limitations we have on discovering these commodities is our ingenuity, our ability to think about this and apply new technologies, new ideas, new inspirations to the problem.
Today's prospectors may be less exposed, but they're every bit as adventurous and just as pugnacious.
We always take the long shot when it comes to geological information, trying to be optimists about the chances of discovering something or knowing that something could be out of sight, that is, at depth, beyond what you can see immediately. So in that sense, we're the ultimate gamblers.
The city stands on the north shore of the Great Slave Lake. Edmonton, its closest large city, is 1,700 kilometers to the south, and there's only one road to get there. Yellowknife was built in the mid-1930s when large deposits of gold were first discovered here. It is base camp for the mines. When he's not out prospecting in the bush, Lou gets together with his friends at the dinner, the prospector's Yellowknife HQ. They exchange news and tips. They keep an eye on metal prices on the Vancouver stock market. Here, they dream of adventure, not wealth.
He came back Sunday night with his wife. We both came back. We all came back on the same flight. But she'll be back, I'm sure. Right.
The last of the gold mines closed in 2004, and Yellowknife thought it would turn into a ghost town. Finding diamond deposits has saved it for at least the next 40 years. To work a mine, you need fuel, you need cement, and you need equipment, vehicles and machinery. Bringing all that in by plane would cost a fortune. So all the heavy material is brought to the mines by road, and in the middle of winter. The only road to the mines from Yellowknife is the ice road, a long trail blazed across the frozen lakes. The ice has to be thick enough to bear the weight of 28-ton trucks. It is checked by ground-penetrating radar every day. It has to be at least 1.04 meters thick. If it's near to this limit, the road maintenance team swings into action. It pumps water from the lake and pours it onto the road. It takes just a few minutes for the water to freeze and make the ice thicker. The road is operated by the mining companies, and they build it every year in January at a cost of approximately $20 million. Last year, it operated for 55 days. 6,832 lorries carried 239,000 tons of freight.
Okay, they're a pretty good bunch. Give them your good side.
You sat in that, we were there for 5 days, and I was working for it.
What?
They never come told us.
They never come told you. I was the first one out.
When the truck drivers come in the front door, they bring in their bill of lading, explaining exactly what their load is on the truck. So we have to double check their loads against what's going on the ice to make sure they meet the weight requirements. So we double check the documents, make a photocopy of them, and then we print their trip tickets according to what's on the computer.
Charlie Lucas. There you go, boys.
Thanks, sir.
Perfect.
Have fun.
Oh, just two of us.
Yeah.
Stay somewhere between the snowbanks. Stay in the cover.
Oh, really? I thought that was that time of year, isn't it?
It is.
Snowbank?
Yeah. Good day. Last truck.
My name is Dave Matter. I work for Nuno Logistics. I'm the dispatch supervisor out of Yellowknife. My responsibility here is to dispatch trucks onto the ice road that service the three mines, and they're called the joint venture. The service here operates on a 24-hour basis, and that's about the main thing that creates any disruption here is if we have bad weather. We do have incidences where we might have traffic blocking the road, but those situations are often handled quickly and efficiently without any delays in traffic.
I'm Sean Sutherland, and I'm heading north to Diavik. I got a load of concrete, I think it is, and yeah, we're about ready to roll here and go north.
If there's a blizzard, the drivers have enough supplies to survive for several days. The trucks travel in convoys of four, with each group 20 minutes behind the one ahead. The ice road is 600 kilometers long. It links the diamond mines at Snap Lake, Diavik, Ekati, and far to the north, Jericho. It's a 16-hour drive to get to Diavik. The drivers spend the night at the mine and return the next day. With no load, the journey takes 10 hours. At kilometer 280, the trees disappear. The only plants that can endure the Arctic winter are shrubs, moss, and lichen. After 2 7-day weeks of 12-hour working days, employees at the mine get 2 weeks off. Leon goes home to Bichoko, an indigenous community of 1,900 inhabitants. Leon has been hunting and trapping animals for their fur since he was a young child.
Our ancestors had to hunt and trap to live. They gathered the fruits of the earth. They hunted ducks and other animals all year round. That's how our people used to live. Some of us are keeping up the tradition. Our parents taught us, and now we're teaching our kids.
Lucas, Leon's youngest son, has seen some hard times. Leon took a year off from the mine to teach his son, by means of hunting and trapping, the ancestral values of their people. Leon, his wife, Kathy, and their five children live in a comfortable, spotlessly clean house on a quiet street in Bichoko.
Our late leaders negotiated the use of the land with the government. Thanks to them, we still have our hunting rights. It's thanks to them we're free to hunt and trap today.
Leon traps sable, lynx, beaver, and wolves. He has won the Top Trapper Award. A Northwest Territories government agent buys the sable furs from him for $65 a piece. They are sold on at the auctions at North Bay, Ontario. After his 2 weeks off, Leon is back at the mine. It's the same rhythm all year round. 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. Today, Leon and Kathy are invited to a friend's wedding at Wati, a Tricho village, 100 kilometers further north from Bichoko. Wati is a Catholic village. It was originally just a hunting and fishing camp where the Tlicho used to meet up. But some fur traders set up business there, and Wati became a village of some 500 inhabitants. Hunting and fishing are still the principal occupations here. There's dance after dance. It goes on for hours. This is a community that really loves its culture. Its chief, Alphonse Nitsiza, reckons that respect for their traditions is the only thing that keeps the young Tlicho from drink and drugs. It's 6:30 in the morning in Yellowknife. There are four flights a week to the diving mine. The mining companies each have their own terminal building. It's a 40-minute flight. In the far north, winter rules with a rod of iron. The least little contravention of its laws can quickly turn to tragedy. The rules of safety simply cannot be bent.
The purpose is to provide all employees with a safe and effective procedure for pit evacuation.
Explosive charges are going to be set down in the A418 open pit. The supervisor is reminding everyone working in the area of the safety procedures. A storm has been forecast. The supervisor informs his teams that he may at any moment order an emergency evacuation of the site.
Evacuation, which of course is myself. We're just getting AC repair, so we'll get that done.
Stretching exercises before work are obligatory. They remind everyone that the body is not a machine. All the equipment for preparing the blast is sent down into the mine. This huge beast is a drill. It's a lot bigger than the ones that bore the holes in the gallery floors, but it works on the same principle.
My name's Brian, and drilling for the drill and blast so we can get the diamonds out. And that's about it.
A drill bit, basically a big cutting tool on the end of a long pole, bites into the kimberlite to bore the holes. The holes are all identified by wooden marker poles.
Hey, we're in a 418 pit here. We're just setting up for a blast here. We've got all the holes drilled. We just finished pumping in emulsion. We've got the boosters and the non-Ls down the hole. And we'll come by with a stemming loader and we'll stem all the holes, fill them back up with gravel. That way it contains the energy in the ground, gives better fragmentation for the blast. And the shovel will come in, then they'll come in and clean this area out, which is approximately a 50,000 ton blast, which will give us around 150,000 carats.
The explosives are brought in by truck. This is a staple emulsion that looks like a gel. It's piped into the holes. The forecast storm arrives. The wind drives the snow up to 60 kilometers an hour. In the space of a few minutes, the temperature drops to under 40 degrees Celsius. All outside operations are suspended. Everyone heads back to base. Is paralyzed. All personnel are confined to quarters. To get from one building to another, they have to take the connecting passages that they call the Arctic corridors. At this moment, Diavik is no longer physically linked with the world.
Hello, guys.
It's hard to be away from your family, from your children. If anything's wrong, you're not there to help. The telephone some consolation. You can call home to see how things are going. If there's a problem, it's hard not to get worried about it. You just want everything to be okay.
There are 600 or 700 people living at Diavik. Second day of the storm. The mine's like a lunar base. Everyone's climbing the walls with boredom.
Yeah.
The wind has dropped. The mine is buried under a very cold, fine snow that penetrates everywhere. Nothing's moving. Open pit A418 is out of action. Time to call in the clearing equipment. The mine slowly coming out of its icy coma. And Dyvik's heart starts to beat again.
Personnel, this is the 2-minute warning for blast.
The countdown to the blasting can begin once more.
Radio silence will remain in effect until the all clear has been sound. However, radio silence may be broken in the case of an emergency. I repeat, this is the 2-minute warning for blast in the 418 pit. Hey, fire.
Antwerp is the world center for the cutting and trading of diamonds. The diamond district is just two streets, not far from the main railway station. It's the most expensive square kilometer on the planet. Last year, the Dyvik mine produced a total of 7,229,932 carats. A carat weighs 0.2 of a gram. The mine keeps the percentage of gem quality of the diamonds they get from Dyvik secret. A rough diamond is shaped like a double pyramid, joined at the bases. When cut, it produces two gems, a large one and a smaller one. The diamond cutters are all extremely secretive about the machines and techniques they have developed. The polishing is done with diamond dust, since nothing but diamond can cut a diamond. A cut and polished diamond has 57 facets, 16 of them on the bottom of the stone. each diamond is unique. And each diamond has its price. I'm an Aboriginal, so diamonds don't really interest me. We mine them because other people like them. The fashion people make rings from them and necklaces. The mine presents everyone who's worked there for 10 years with a diamond. I took mine back home. I didn't know what to do with it. So I just hung it on the wall.
We will be looking for diamonds here for the next 100 years. No problem. We haven't come close to finding all of the kimberlites in the Northwest Territories or in Nunavut. And experience tells us that this will go on for at least 100 years, maybe longer. What are diamonds to me? Diamonds to me are not particularly valuable items, but I realize that they are valuable to many other people, and that's what counts. Doesn't matter what I think with respect to the value of diamonds.